This is Father Ted, and you are listening to the Bunker Jiu-Jitsu Podcast. All right, everybody, welcome back to the Bunker Podcast. And today I'm honored to have the second black belt on the show. Sorry that you weren't the first one, David. But David is also the most senior black belt that I've ever had on the program. His name is David Gonzalez. He is teaching up in Gracie Humeta Bolton, right? You are third or fourth degree now?
Well, fourth degree.
You're a fourth degree black belt. I'll let you talk about where you come from, your lineage, all that kind of stuff. Kind of interesting is that David is also, in addition to being a wonderful instructor, he's also a parishioner at my church here. So we're kind of part of two different families. We got our jiu-jitsu family. We got also our Orthodox family. So that's kind of rare because usually all my friends who are in jiu-jitsu have nothing to do with my with my religious world. But this is kind of the situation where they intersect. So, Professor, it's an honor to have you on the podcast. Welcome.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm excited to talk.
Yeah. Well, on that note, tell us a little bit about yourself. You know, where you come from. Okay. Maybe you know a little bit of your background and how you got into jiu-jitsu.
All right. Well, I was born in New Jersey in 1968. No, I'm from New Jersey originally.
Hence the accent.
Hence my terrible way of speaking.
Oh man, that's good.
I lived in a really rough neighborhood, and so I decided at 18 to join the military to get away from there.
Wow.
So I joined the Air Force.
And, Air Force?
Yeah, U.S. Air Force.
How did that happen?
You know, I come from a family of a long military tradition. I had originally signed up with the Marine Corps, but my brother was in the Air Force, and he said, go back to that recruiter and go to the Air Force recruiter. You don't want to join the Marine Corps. There's no future for you.
Okay.
And so I said, okay. So I went back into the chagrin of the Marine Corps recruiter. He sees me sitting with Byron. His name was Byron, Air Force recruiter. And he's signing me up, and he waves off the Marine and tells him, don't worry about it. I got the pay. I'm doing his paperwork now. And so I did that. I dropped out of high school. Mm-hmm. And my Air Force recruiter took me to get my GED. Mm-hmm. Which is General Equivalency Diploma, and my ASVAB, all in the same weekend. So ASVAB is the qualifier to join the armed forces. It's a test.
Sure.
And I qualified for the Air Force. And so I did that on a weekend. And then that Tuesday, I was on a plane to San Antonio, Texas. So it was that fast. And I never looked back.
You know, so you went to basic training there?
Went to basic training in San Antonio, Texas. I did my tech school in Mississippi, in Biloxi. Mm-hmm. And then right from there, I was stationed at the McClellan Air Force Base. And at McClellan, I started doing taekwondo. Mm-hmm. I actually competed in taekwondo. I up to the point that I competed at the 4th Western Annual Armed Forces Taekwondo Championships in Vegas.
Oh, so you started training in the military taekwondo?
Yeah, taekwondo. I had done karate and boxing prior to that. Mm-hmm. And we can get into that. I did Police Athletic League and Boys Club.
Okay.
They were free programs. Mm-hmm. That were sponsored by Donald Trump, by the way.
And interesting. Hmm.
Then I started doing taekwondo. I competed in taekwondo. I was served overseas. I did more taekwondo. Then I did aikido, did a little bit of judo. Mm-hmm. And then I got back to McClellan Air Force Base about 5 years later.
Okay. Fast forward. What were you doing as far as what was your specialization in the Air Force?
I was in the Air Force. I was an information systems radio operator.
Okay, cool.
And then... to go to the overseas, I had volunteered for a special duty assignment working in the postal system, Air Force postal system.
Okay.
And that was a gravy job. That was wonderful. A lot of work, a lot of hours.
Sure.
But you get to live in Spain.
Yeah.
Right. So I lived in Spain just outside of Madrid.
Nice.
Fast forward 1994. I get assigned because the base is closing. I get assigned back to McClellan. So I go back to McClellan. And when I get there, a buddy of mine that had been with me in Spain asked me if I had seen the UFC.
And because 93 was,
I didn't know what the heck he was talking about. I said, what is this? You know, he goes, come to my house. So I came to over his house, and he puts in a VHS tape, and he had the recording of the UFC 1. And I was like, this is BS. This is not real. This can't be real.
Ken Shamrock. And
I couldn't believe it. And then I signed up at a taekwondo school around the corner from my house. I lived in Citrus Heights at the time. Near Sacramento, and I signed up for a taekwondo school, and it just happens that my taekwondo instructor, you know, did judo, he did escrima, he did Muay Thai, he was into everything. And he had a friend named David Kovar who ran a big martial arts program. He's a famous guy in the States in the martial arts mm-hmm. world, educational funding company, all this other mm-hmm. stuff. And he had invited us to a seminar, our whole academy. And I said, what kind of seminar is it? He goes, a jiu-jitsu seminar, Gracie jiu-jitsu seminar. I was like, that's the guy that was on the UFC yeah. thing. And so I was super interested.
This was the early years. There was yeah. there was no jiu-jitsu clubs. It was just seminars, like yeah. this, just introducing people, right?
So I went to this seminar. And the seminar was in, I think it was in 95, February or something, 95. And I went to the seminar. And it was Half Gracie, Caesar Gracie. Oh, wow. And then guys that you know about now, like Kurt Osiander. There was a guy named Derek Robinson who's a black belt now, I think, under Cassio Wernick. So all these guys were there. But
all these guys were now, these guys were all newbies too. They were all like
blue yeah, belts. He was a blue belt. Yeah, Kurt was a blue belt at the time.
They were the early guys, yeah.
And so was Derek. And the other guys, I can't remember their names. But, you know, I get there and it was like, how is this happening? This can't be real. Mm-hmm. I was dumbfounded because I was stand up. Guy and I had done stand-up judo, but mm-hmm. we never went to the ground to do Nawaza. Like Nawaza wasn't a thing that they taught.
It wasn't emphasized even. Right. Judo. It still isn't today. A little more.
They do it more, I think. But now, but back then, I didn't see any Nawaza. It was all stand-up work.
Yeah.
So at the end of the seminar, they were handing out flyers, and it so told you where the school was. And so I had a buddy named Steve Nelson and I, and we were friends with Derek Robinson because he was a Kovar guy. He was a mm-hmm. Dave Kovar guy. And we went up to Derek and like, hey, when do you guys go down there? He goes, Wednesday mornings, we go to this class. They have a special class mm-hmm. Wednesday mornings. Now it's called, you know, now I was talking to Hal a couple of years ago. And he was like, yeah, the famous Wednesday class. Mm-hmm. So I said, let's go. Next week, we're going. So the next week,
Derek. So how far was this from you?
About an hour and a half.
Wow.
Yeah. That's how it was back then.
Yeah.
Right? There was no sure. school around the corner, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So on that Wednesday, the following Wednesday, they came and picked me up at my house. It was Derek and Steve Nelson and a bunch of coffee. And we drove down.
And how old were you now?
I'm 26, maybe 25. 25, 26, around there. And we head down.
And you were still in the Air Force?
I was active duty. I was working swing shift. So I had to get back in time to go to work.
Sure.
So I was under the gun. But we go down there. We walk in. And Derek is friends with Kurt Osiander and all those dudes. And he goes, hey, man, this guy here doesn't believe in jiu-jitsu. And he's pointing at me.
Uh-oh.
And I'm like, oh, man, he put me on the spot. And he goes, yeah. And he's super cool. He's like one of those, yeah, dude, you know, one of those guys. Talks real cool.
Yeah.
And he says.
Californian?
Yeah, like California style. Right? Even though he's like Argentinian German or something, I think Kurt is. But anyway, he goes, why don't you believe it? I said, it can't be possible, man. I've been doing stand-up. You know, we've been taught that if you hit somebody right on the button, the fight is over. He goes, yeah, that's possible, but
what if you miss?
But what if you miss? And I clinch you. He goes, tell you what, show me how you, what's your fighting stance? So I got into a fighting stance. He goes, what's your best kick? He goes, just throw it. And I was nervous, man. I'm shaking. My knees are shaking at this point. I'm like, I'm going to kick this guy for real? And I'm thinking I'm going to hurt him. I throw the kick, catches it, gently puts me down, passes. Now I know he passed my guard. Uh-huh. And then he armbars me. He goes, you want to do that again? And I said, yeah, I want to do that again. So that's how it kind of started. I took that class. I didn't speak Portuguese at the time. Now I'm fluent. But at the time, I didn't understand.
Of course you are.
I didn't understand a word. They were like, Caesar spoke really good English. Mm-hmm. Right? He's American, former Marine. This guy... Mm-hmm. But Half, his English was terrible.
Sure.
You know, so he'd walk us through class. And it wasn't jiu-jitsu like jiu-jitsu class today. This was, jiu-jitsu back then was about fighting. It wasn't about what you're doing now.
Yeah, it was the self-defensive aspect.
It wasn't so much like doing the stand-up self-defense. I'm talking stand-up, guy's going to punch you, clinch,
yes.
fight to take him down, and then keep going from there.
Sure.
Right? And so that's the jiu-jitsu I learned there.
Sure. Yeah.
And then find out that Dave Kovar had an open mat at his academy every week as well, upstairs in this private training area. Mm-hmm. And so I signed up that day at Caesar's school. It was actually Caesar's school, even though Half was teaching there with Caesar. And I signed up that day. It was $75 a month, unlimited training. But I can only go Wednesdays and Saturdays, but it turned out to be every other Saturday for me. I couldn't, sure. I couldn't manage.
For back then, that's expensive too.
Yeah. $75 was money back then.
Yeah, 100%.
But then I found out that I could supplement my training at Dave's place. Huh. And so at Dave's place, they would send a representative, a blue belt or like Kirk or somebody, yeah. Right, to come and just monitor the open mat. They weren't teaching nothing. You just come in and whatever you learned at class on Wednesday, drill, Saturday, yeah. You drill and then you roll, yeah. You know? And it was a lot of rolling, a lot of injuries.
Yeah.
And then shortly after that, a guy named Nino Shembri came. I don't know if you ever heard of him. He's a famous Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, Gracie Baja, black belt, world champion several times over, pride fighter. And he was running the open mat at Kovar's after a while and teaching classes. And that was how I got my start in Jiu-Jitsu. Mm-hmm. And I was there from February 95 to December 96 because I shortly January 1st, 97, I was on an airplane to the Azores.
Okay.
And I was getting stationed there. So I got stationed in the Azores. There was no jiu-jitsu there. So I was doing jiu-jitsu with friends of mine. I had one guy got kicked out of college. He was a wrestler. This guy named Danny Martinez. And we used to roll. And then I would show him whatever rudimentary things I learned in jiu-jitsu class, mm-hmm. right? Which is all based on, you know, not getting punched in the face, basically.
Sure.
Suzanne Moraes. There was a girl named Susan Moraes. Yeah. That's where I learned Portuguese.
Of course, yeah.
In Portugal. And then there were guys that would come into the rec center, and it was a Muay Thai group in the corner, Azorians, and they were always checking us out. And so once in a while, they would probe to come see and try. You know, and it never worked out for them. It was always a bad experience. And even some Americans, you know, they would come down, that's military guys, and they would be like, that stuff will never work on me. And I'm like, I don't know if it will either. You know, like I was never cocky about it, and I was like, let's see. And then I made friends, you know, like we would do our thing. Danny would do something. I would do something. Susan, the girl, would do something. And then we'd make friends. We find out there was a judo school about 10 minutes away. So we all went and signed up. And we're training with a guy named Mario Coelho, who is still my friend on Facebook and in Portugal and stuff. That's my wife's island. Her family's from there. And so I would take judo, but I would always get it to the ground somehow. To grapple, so I would take the matches to the ground, and I most of the time would get an arm lock or a choke
in the judo class.
And so he started noticing that I did a lot of netwaza, you know, and it didn't help. I was wearing a Gracie back then. It was called Gracie Systems on my gi.
Yeah.
Right. I still have the back piece in my house in a frame. That was my first official jiu-jitsu gi at the academy in Pleasant Hill. Cesar Gracie Academy. Anyway, so I would take people down. They throw me and end up in an arm lock. Mm-hmm. Or they throw me and end up in a choke. I end up on their back and I'm choking them, right? And so he liked it, and he went and got me a book by Neil Adams. I don't know if you ever heard of a famous judo player, famous for his arm locks. And he, you know, in Portuguese, which I didn't really understand 100% at the time yet, he told me, I know you like arm locks, so here's a good book about arm locks. And so I took that, and I ate that book. Like, I digested it, because there was really no videos or instructions.
Yeah, of course.
There was nothing, right?
No internet yet?
There was nothing.
No YouTube?
There was internet, but it wasn't like it is now. It was
not the 90s.
And so that book, I devoured it. And that, you know, I just kept training in judo, and then I eventually fell off. I met my wife, and I started partying, because I'm a young single guy living overseas. Mm-hmm. And then all martial arts kind of fell out of favor. I would still do stuff at the rec center with my friends, but nothing serious. Uh-huh. Fast forward, I moved to D.C. I was stationed there at Andrews Air Force Base at the time. Now it's called Joint Base Andrews. Uh-huh. And then I was at the 1st Helicopter Squadron. I was a command post radio operator. And I was there for about a year and really didn't do anything but judo. Like, I went to a judo club they had on base.
So you're still a white belt in jiu-jitsu right now?
Yeah, I'm a white belt.
There was no blue, nothing yet.
I'm a white belt, but I just had my arm locked down. That was pretty much my only weapon. Mm-hmm. and that was it. You know, I would do the judo class sporadically, and then I was always coming up to Canada on my days off, because I'd work 24 hours on, 72 hours off.
What were you doing in Canada?
Visiting my wife.
Oh, so your wife, okay, so her family came here.
Yeah, they moved here from Portugal, and I met her there because she was on holidays visiting Portugal. That's how I met her.
Okay, but you weren't married yet. You were dating.
No, we were dating. We were engaged and whatnot. Yeah, so I was always commuting back and forth.
I see.
On my days off.
Well, that's how you showed up here.
Yeah, there was no time for training when I'm doing that. You know, it was very little. So I would sporadically go to the judo class, get a roll in, get a couple of takedowns in. You know, it's an hour and a half class, and it was fun. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't my focus. My focus was, you know, getting out of the service, getting, they call it an early out because there was an overage in my technical field. Mm-hmm. So I was trying to use that to get out so I can come be with my wife, you know, get married. And I already had a job offer here and I was just getting my ducks lined up to move to Canada. So fast forward, I moved in 2000, April 1st, 2001. It was actually March 30th, 2001 that I drove across the border. And then April 1st, 2001, that's the joke in the family. I came here on April Fool's Day. Uh-huh. Well, I'll never live that one down. You know? But anyways, I started.
That's my wife's birthday, by the way.
Is it April Fool's Day?
She's born on the big joke.
So they got you too, see? So that's it. I started working. Got married through the church to make it official. I mean, not through the church, through the city hall first.
Sure.
June 3rd, 2000, we got married through city hall, but we didn't recognize our marriage between ourselves because we didn't get married to the church and we were both people of faith. So
you were both Catholic at the time?
At the time, right. And so I was like, you know, it's not a real marriage until we get married to the church. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she was on board with that as well. We both agree. And then we finally, you know, tied the knot, 2001, coming up May 19th, we got married. And we moved into our home in Woodbridge and I was looking for jiu-jitsu, but never really found anything, right? I had a neighbor that just happened to have trained jiu-jitsu. Oh. And he came over to my house to watch UFC. So we're watching UFC. He goes, yeah, man, I used to train jiu-jitsu. And he's talking about jiu-jitsu. And I was like, I used to train jiu-jitsu. Where did you train? And so he told me it was the Grappling Arts Academy under Sylvan Maroney and Danny Maroney. And he goes, that doesn't exist anymore, but there's still an academy on 27 in Astona where they teach jiu-jitsu. I said, I have to go check it out. So I think it was the next day or the Monday, I went to the academy. And I met Professor Danny Maroney. Mm-hmm. I walked in and, you know, I talked to him. I asked him who he got his black belt from and where he trained and all that. And he asked me where I trained and all that. And so that was it. I said, when's your next class? He goes, tomorrow night. I think it was at 7:15 or 7:30. I said, I'll be here. And I said, do you mind if I have a gi? Can I wear it? He goes, yeah, wear whatever you want. I was like, okay, cool. So that was it. I took my first class with Professor Danny here in Ontario. And then...
But this was not Gracie Humaita yet?
No. Yeah. It was called Bravado Jiu-Jitsu at the time. Mm-hmm. And Danny was the first black belt in Canada. I know there's been some controversy about that, but there's no denying it. Even Silvio Baring confirmed he was the first non-Brazilian jiu-jitsu black belt in Canada. There was a bit of falling out there regarding money.
Sure.
Always is. And sales of patches and t-shirts. And so the guy who promoted him, his name is Mauricio Pereira. Mm-hmm. Mauricio Hunter Pereira.
Yep.
Or Mauricio Baring. He went through some aliases. Maurisong is his nickname. And he denied promoting him after he did, but there was too many witnesses to deny it. And so eventually Silvio Baring came clean and said, yes, he in fact did promote him. And I'm sure he would have been a black belt regardless, you know.
Sure.
So then that ended that whole controversy. So I got my blue belt through Danny. I started in September or October 2001 with Danny, and then in March he gave me a blue belt. I hadn't been a white belt for so long.
Sure,
he knew,
sure.
Like he knew from
you had your basics already.
Yeah, he knew from watching me train. Excuse me, from watching me training that I wasn't like a noob, right? Mm-hmm. I was rough. Obviously, I was a white belt still. Absolutely, there was no doubt. But I wasn't a complete noob coming off the street. Like I knew chokes, I knew arm bars, I knew sweeps, I knew how to disengage, engage, and takedowns. And so that was it. And I didn't, I wasn't happy with the blue belt because I felt I didn't deserve it. Just kind of like the other interviewee you had recently.
Yeah.
And so I went to a guy named Rodrigo Munduruca, who is he's a well-known
Munduruca. Yeah, he was he was in Winnipeg.
Yeah, he was in Winnipeg. Yeah, exactly.
So Father Thomas.
That's right. There you go.
Fighting priests. That was his first professor.
So him, he was very good friends with Danny, and he was always in our academy. Like, he was always back and forth teaching, and I would take privates from him. And I asked him one day, would you test me for my blue belt? Because I don't feel confident. He goes, why would you think that? And I said, because, and it's stupid now. I think about it now, and I'm like, how ridiculous. But back then I said, you know, I always wanted my belts coming from a Brazilian. Mm-hmm. That was my goal. I wanted Brazilian jiu-jitsu black belt to come from a Brazilian. Now I think it's ludicrous. You know, it doesn't. I don't know what I was thinking. Mm-hmm. It was immature. But he tested me. He put me through the grinder. He made me regret my choices. But then he promoted me to blue belt. He basically blessed my blue belt.
Yeah.
And I wasn't the only one. There was another guy there. I'm not going to mention his name because I don't know if he wants me to talk about it. But he was not happy with his purple belt. And so he tested for his purple belt through Rodrigo as well on the same day. Mm-hmm. So we tested together. And he brought in all the ringers, you know, to put us through the Shark Tank and, you know, torture us, made us demonstrate technique over and over and over again. It was a good eye-opening experience.
And, yeah, he was a good professor. Like, I never trained with him, obviously, but as I said, Father Thomas went all the way from white to purple with him before he came down to Toronto, because he came here and said he'd become a priest, right? And then he was under George Brito after that for his brown and his black, right?
There you go.
But yeah, he had good foundations and...
Yeah, he's a quality instructor, no doubt. Like, Rodrigo is a great instructor. He's a great person. He's funny as all heck. I love that guy. And anyway, so he was a big influence on me in that regard. And then from there, I got my purple belt from Danny. And we had a little bit of a falling out. As usual, it's over, you know, fees, right? I was teaching 4 days a week at his academy. I just felt like I was paying more than everybody else. And, you know, it was a stupid argument on both our parts. But we're over that now. We're really good friends. You know, tighter than ever. Matter of fact, we're supposed to be having lunch in a few weeks.
Good.
Just getting together. But, you know, you go through these things in jiu-jitsu because, you know, they say no ego in jiu-jitsu. I find that to be the stupidest thing I've ever heard because jiu-jitsu is full of ego. There's nothing but it. You can't get through jiu-jitsu without ego.
All of life.
Right.
It's like that.
There's no way. You can't survive it. So I got my purple belt through Danny, and then I left, and I started training with my regular training partners, Professor Paul Abel, Professor Chad King, Professor Will Tirado, Professor Trevor Lewis, a bunch of guys. We would just train up in Newmarket. They had a cage up there, and so we just trained in the cage. That's all we did. And then my son was born. And I started training once a week only. But that once a week was like 6 hour trainings. Yeah. 6 hour training for one day, right? Just try to get it all in one day. I was training in Newmarket. And then by then, Paul Abel had started running a program in Bolton. It wasn't Gracie Umatai, it was RGDA, Hoyler Gracie David Adib.
Okay.
And so I was back and forth between that teaching. Then I was able to train more through the week, and I started teaching in Bolton. And I never wanted to be a teacher of jiu-jitsu. I just kind of fell into it.
Okay.
Through need.
So you started teaching at purple or after?
Blue.
Oh, blue. Wow, good.
I had as a blue belt, they made me put a red patch, a red bar.
Yes,
I've on heard my about belt this. To be a coach, right?
There's certain groups.
So I was teaching as a blue belt, man. I never wanted to teach. I think
Dave Kama does that too. They do that. These guys are under Hicks and Gracie.
Yeah,
they do that as well. They do the red bar for those who teach.
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
But it's unique. Not everybody does that.
Not everybody does that. Well, Danny used to do that.
Yeah. Right?
So you got the red bar, and I had sewn on, you know, that meant I was a coach. So I've always been teaching through the circumstances, through the need of the academy. It wasn't because I wanted to. I preferred just to stand there in line like everybody else, joke around, and train.
Sure.
But somebody has to teach.
Yeah, that's true.
Right. And so that was it. I started teaching for Paul and Bolton, you know, help him out, give him so he has a night off. And I had my little following, of course. You always have your little following. Even from the Bravado days, I had a little group of guys that would come train in my house because I've always had a home dojo. And then I got my brown belt from David Adib. And then about 4 years later, I got my black belt from Hoi Lan directly. But I got my my brown belt here in Woodbridge, but my black belt I got in New Jersey. I didn't get it here in Canada.
Okay.
I got it back in my home state.
Okay.
In David Adib's Academy.
Nice.
April 5th, 2009, I got my black belt from Hoi Lan himself. You know, it was. I didn't expect it. It was kind of like one of those things. It's a seminar. At the end of the seminar, he's talking, and then he starts calling people up, and he promoted a guy named Moshe Cates, good black belt. And then I heard my name. I was like, what?
That's the best way, though.
That was it.
It's unexpected. Like, I get the gradings, like, when they do group gradings, because it is a community building thing. Like, you know, sometimes in my old gym, like, they do, like, a whole thing where, like, you know, you're doing a potluck and you're doing kind of thing and, you know, you're doing the promotions all together. But the bad thing with that is that then people have expectations and all this weird stuff.
It's all marketing, right? To me. I see it as marketing. To me, it's just marketing your academy, marketing your product. That's what I see it as. Whereas the old way, I see it as, like, it's your moment. It's your moment. It's not anyone else's moment. I don't even like stripes.
Session, right?
I don't like stripes.
Yeah.
Well, stripes are gimmies. Like, these are things that keep people interested.
The old ways was nothing. But mind you, okay, the old ways was blue belt and black. That was it. And then later the other
those
belts
are the
came
real
in.
Old ways.
The old,
we're beyond that. But like, I think that, you know, white, blue, purple, brown, black is enough, right? Like, that's enough.
Yeah. Yeah. But people need, you know, especially in America, like, we have this kind of, like, I don't know. It's like, it is business, but it's also like, I think it's a mentality as well. It's like, you need to be graded. You want to know. Like, the Americans are very much like this. And Canadians, like, Western world, right? As opposed to the East.
Right.
Like, and South America is different because South America is much more like Europe. Like, you know, it's like, you get this European feel, right? Or Portuguese, like, it's in Spanish. And, and they don't care. It's just, you're just doing it. And when it happens, it happens. But here, people need to know their progress. It's like kids' belts.
Absolutely.
It's like, kids' belts are just, they're just borrowed from Taekwondo. And
that's right.
They never existed.
To keep them interested.
Yeah. You know? And I get it. Little kids, they want to see progress. They want to have encouragement. Like, it's a psychological thing too. It's not just money. Some places are money, I think, but it's also like, even my kids, they all training for 5 years now. I try to always remind them, like, don't worry about the belts. Don't worry about that. And they don't really focus,
mm-hmm.
but you know, little kids, they need a little encouragement. It's like, you know,
keep their enthusiasm and motivate not, them
100%. Right. Yeah. And that's why you kind of create that system, whatever. I get it, but
I get it. Like, I absolutely do understand it. It's just, I was born in 68, man. I'm from a different generation than most of these guys nowadays in jiu-jitsu.
And you started it when it was at the beginning, so they didn't have any of these things. Then you've seen in your career all these things get implemented.
That's 30 years.
There was no IBJJF when you started.
Years
there was
in
no, jiu-jitsu. There was none of this stuff, right? So now, but it's actually kind of quite amazing, though, like, how it was when you started and how it is now.
Right.
Sports jiu-jitsu didn't really exist.
Like, well, they did. They was sport jiu-jitsu, but it wasn't to the point where it is now, where it's like so unrealistic that, you know, I believe that how you train is how you're going to fight in the street.
Sure.
Right. Yeah. So if you're the kind of guy that's used to just jump and guard all these things, good luck to you. You know, that's not going to work out very well. Like, and I'm a world star guy. That's what I like watching. I like watching world star because that's going to show you what's happening out in the streets and how far your jiu-jitsu is going to go and what you really should be preparing for, as opposed to, you know, what are you training for? Are you training for medals or are you training for life?
I guess it depends on the people. Well, you ask people, like, it's a legitimate question, though.
Right. Like, and I don't care. I'm not going to vilify anyone that trains for, like, you want to train for sport.
The sport guys are not doing it for self-defense.
That's
doing
great.
It for the,
and you want to train for self-defense and MMA, Vatula, whatever you want to call it. That's great, too.
Sure.
But don't sit there and say you're the guy that's going to be in the street. You're going to be fine. You're alive. You know, don't,
you're not going to sit on your butt in the concrete and wait for the guy to come.
Put self-defense on your moniker.
Like,
right? They put it on their moniker. Learn jiu-jitsu for self-defense, and your first class is X guard.
Yeah.
Come on, bro. Like, you're not selling the product that you're promising the people.
Sure.
It's a bait and switch. If you walk in my academy, we say self-defense, you're going to get self-defense.
Oh, yeah. I know. I came. I really enjoyed it.
Right?
It was good.
You're going to get self-defense.
Every class has that element to it. That's what I liked about your academy. Like, you guys also do other things too.
Absolutely.
Like,
we do sport. We do sport.
But you always, I find, like, you have a structure, right? So you always have, like, you have your warm-ups, and then you always have, like, some kind of self-defensive technique.
So, first, situational, right?
Always, right? And then
we do a takedown.
Yeah.
Like, my class, you do it. Yeah. You're not going to take my class without a takedown. I've never taught a class without a takedown. I don't know what it is to teach a class without a takedown.
Yeah.
But I've gone into classes where the first thing you do, we're already butt scooting. We just walked in the door.
So many gyms don't even know how to do them. They don't even cover it.
Right, exactly. So, you know, you're deficient. I'm not vilifying anyone, and I'm not trying to say I'm a better black belt than anyone else, because I'm not. I suck. You know, I'm just like everybody else in the grind. I'm trying to get better.
Yeah, but it's your philosophy. It's what you want. That's why
my philosophy is, if you are a black belt, you call yourself a jiu-jitsu black belt, you should be able to be familiar with self-defense, mm-hmm. stand-up work, throws, takedowns, wrestling takedowns. You should be proficient. And then you should be proficient on your back.
You should be
well-rounded. And, you know, at some point in time during the progression of jiu-jitsu's growth, the legit guys were the guys that could do everything. They weren't the greatest jiu-jitsu guys in the world. Like, you watch the old fights. They weren't the best jiu-jitsu guys in the world. They weren't even as refined as people are now. And these are Brazilians I'm talking about.
They
were sloppy, lazy, you know.
Yep.
But they could defend themselves in a fight.
100%.
And they could do sport, right?
Yes.
And then those guys were considered the legit guys because they could fight. Then there came the advent of the sport growth. And now the sport growth guy, he's the legit guy. And the guy who knows how to fight is not the legit guy no more. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden now it's but reverse roles. But the reality is, let's get one of those guys that knows how to fight, put him in a ring with a guy who only does sport.
Yes.
And see how it works out. And we're seeing it play out a lot in UFC and in other fighting events where these guys are great sport jiu-jitsu guys. They come in there and they get a 3-year college wrestler who knows a little bit of stand-up, and they take his lunch money.
Sure. And you can tell from the schools they come from, like, you know, where, like, the types of things that, like, when jiu-jitsu fighters, players, like, when they leave, like, IBJJF, for example, they're, like you said, they're going into, like, MMA or, like, mixed martial arts, you can see where they're gravitating to, right? So, for example, like, what I'm thinking in my mind is, like, the contrast between, let's say, Marcus Almeida, Puxeixa, right, on one side, right, who is a legitimate fighter.
Amazing.
Right, yeah, right? But look where he's coming from, right? So even when he was winning IBJJF Worlds, you watch the way he fights, the way he rolls, you can tell that he has that kind of, like, street fighting, self-defensive, right? And then you have somebody, for example, like Musumeci, right? I'm not knocking Musumeci.
Not at all.
He's a different person,
beautiful,
right?
Beautiful martial art.
Yeah, but he's not going to fight. Like, his fights are, like, these kind of, like, technical, like,
crab rides.
He's not doing MMA. He's not doing stand-up. He can't. He'll get killed, right? So it's different rule sets that he's going for,
right?
Because he's the guy who's going to sit and go for the leg locks, right? Things like that, right? He's brilliant in his own way. But you're not going to stick him with somebody like Marcus. Not like I'm saying size, but I mean the style.
Right.
It's two different things altogether.
Hodger talked about it. Hodger and Mackenzie Dern. Hodger says 80% of all the jiu-jitsu he learned was useless in a fight.
Well, Hodger is a perfect example. The greatest of all time, one could say. You know what I mean?
In my opinion,
well, he beat Buchecha too. Remember, he came out of retirement? That was like one of the best fights of all time.
White belted him.
Yeah. It was basic jiu-jitsu. Basic people, when you see your basic, people think it's bad, like it's dumb jiu-jitsu or it's unrefined. No, it was basic close guard, basic mount, basic choke. Well, he took his back, basic choke, like
basic, all of it,
and he couldn't stop it. That's what it was amazing about. And he was older, and he came out of retirement. I think it was like he hadn't fought in like 7 years, something like that. And he came out and he beat Buchecha, like who was at the top of his game,
top of the food chain,
and physically, like one could say, you know,
imposing,
bigger, stronger, all this kind of stuff. And he just destroyed him. It just goes to show you, like, it's just the classic basic Gracie jiu-jitsu,
right? And Mackenzie Dern, another great example. Yeah. She was starting to train for MMA.
Yes,
and first words out of her mouth were, "I'm a white belt in this. Like, this is my jiu-jitsu is useless."
Yes,
and you know. That should be an eye opener and something that everyone in the jiu-jitsu world should be going, wait a minute, maybe we're not training for the best. Maybe we're not getting the product that we signed up for. Because why does everybody walk into a jiu-jitsu academy? Most people, not everyone, because I've had people come in and say, I want to try a sport, right?
Yeah.
But most people, when I ask them, why did you choose jiu-jitsu? And I always ask new people when you walk in the door, they go, I want to learn how to defend myself.
Yes.
I never have once. I've had a couple that have come from other academies already, blue belts, purple belts, brown belts, that have said, I want to train more so that I can compete more. Mm. Very rare.
So, I mean, I'll ask you, like, I'm going to ask you maybe one or two questions. So, one, like, and this is actually kind of interesting because I've never done this before on the podcast. So, some people email me questions, like some people email my bunker thing and they're like, could you ask these questions of your guests?
Okay.
I'm like, okay, that's cool. Like, this is great. Like, you know, so some people who are actually, of the 10 people that listen to this podcast, you know, like some people were actually listening. And I'm one like, of them. You know, there you go. I appreciate that. So somebody said, ask your guest this. It says, in your jiu-jitsu journey, what were some obstacles that you had to overcome and how much of it was a mental versus a physical issue?
What I had to overcome was I have a long history of back problems.
Mm-hmm.
It started in the Pleasant Hill Academy, I think, when it started my cervical spine is where it started. I was training with a guy, he was standing above me, and I had a collar and sleeve, and I blocked his feet, and I pulled him into me.
Mm-hmm.
But when I pulled him into me, my head was too far forward. He landed on the back of my, mm-hmm. like on the, with his chest on the back yeah. of my head here, on the top of my head.
Bent you forward.
And he bent me forward so hard that I had two herniations. I had an anterior and a posterior herniation in my cervical spine. That started some problems. And then I started experiencing sciatica. This is back in 95, mm-hmm. 96.
Which is horrible. I've had it too.
Yeah. And then just throughout the years, it just got progressively worse and worse. And to the point where I'd be at training in class and then I couldn't walk. And they'd have to carry me to my car. Literally, the people in the academy would have to carry me to my car, get me to my car so I can drive home. And it was a stick shift at the time. And then, you know, get like a muscle relaxer in me, anti-inflammatory, go to the doctor, go through all the rigmarole of physio and all that mm-hmm. stuff. And then get back on track and start training again. And then that was so challenging that it made me think about quitting jiu-jitsu every time I stepped on the mat.
Sure.
But I never did. And it got to the point where my vertebrae in my lower, my L5, I think it was, I was training with a guy who's 300 pounds.
Just like me.
And he slipped. He was wearing no gi. I was wearing a gi. And the mat was very slippery. And he slipped and he fell on me. Uh-huh. And at first we were both laughing. And then I went to move and I couldn't move. And I thought I was paralyzed. The disc material exploded out. And so then I required back surgery for that. That was back in 2018 or 2017 it happened. I got the I got the surgery a couple months later in 2018. It was like
just before COVID.
Yeah.
The year before.
And so I got the surgery. And then the road to recovery to keep training. Mm-hmm. I was always at the academy.
Sure.
Right? I couldn't walk. I had a cane.
Mm-hmm.
It was so bad. I went to see Hoyler up in Barry. And I had to ride in the back of the truck, laying on my side, like shaking in pain. And I had my gi on already. I put it on at home so that I could just walk on the mat with Master Hoyler. And when he saw me, he was like, oh, man, give me a hug. You know, it was like, you know, he did a little talk. Like, this is, you know, this is one of my black belts. He shows up like this.
Oh.
And people make excuses not to show up. You know, it was really nice. My family was there. And then, you know, I couldn't stay. I got back in the truck and went home. I just wanted to see Hoyler. So that's been my biggest challenge in jiu-jitsu is my physical problems, uh-huh. right? Like, then I had knee surgery. Now I need knee surgery. I need ankle surgery. I need shoulder surgery, but you know, I'm kind of holding out. I'm 56. I'm still training. I'm still teaching.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not rolling as much as I used to. I pick who I roll with. I roll with light guys. You know, but I'm not making excuses. You know, I just tap, and you know, that's the reality of jiu-jitsu. You're on a, you know, there's peaks and valleys in jiu-jitsu.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And I've peaked as much as I was going to peak. Now I'm in the valley, and that's fine. I'm good with being in the valley because I'm surrounded by good people.
Sure.
I'm doing something I love no matter what.
And you want longevity, too. Yeah. Right?
I
want to
keep doing
that.
You know, I don't want to stop. I don't want to be the guy who doesn't tap in training because he has to prove I'm a black belt. You know, I don't care, dude. Like, I'll tap to a blue belt the same way I'll tap to another black belt. And I tap blue belts the same way I tap all the black belts. It's not a problem.
Sure.
But I'm not going to risk any further injury on myself to, you know, because I have something to prove to anybody. You know, I have something to share. Now I'm at the point where I have something to share, you know.
Sure.
And I think I can share really good jiu-jitsu because I have good sources that teach me good jiu-jitsu.
Uh-huh.
You know, and I'm not just talking about Hoyler. I'm talking about all the black belts that I get to train with, you know, on my team, like Paulo Brandão, Morango, all these people that, you know, they have so much knowledge to share. Even Megaton, whenever he's on the mat, he's got something to share. Come here, come here. He has a little group, and he's always sharing technique with us. There's another guy named Marcus Nerat. You know, he's probably not a name you heard of, but in Brazil, he's a name. You know, and this guy's a world, multiple-time world champion. Mm-hmm. He's a little guy, old little guy, and he always has something to show, something that's going to change your game changers. You know, yeah. Like a lasso guard pass. And it's like, why didn't I think of that?
Because experience, right? They have
and it's just simplicity. Like they've taken things that they've simplified them, you know, and so they're always willing to share. So that's the thing that I like the most. You know, I get to still be part of the team. I get to teach my students. I get to watch them grow. Like now we got a more of a competition team going on.
Sure.
And more before, our guys were all MMA. You know, like most of my students would do tournaments here and there, but most of them fought in the cage. Like Anthony Romita is one of my black belts. He fought MMA. Jeremy DiChiara, he was a purple belt of mine. Now he's a brown belt because he moved out to London, Ontario, or something, or Burlington, and he fought MMA. You got Anastasia Nikolakakos. She's a brown belt under me. Yep, and she's a pro fighter. Jay Figgs, he fought, not professionally, but he fought two amateur fights. Jason Sagal, he went all the way up to the UFC. Mm-hmm. You know, he fought in the UFC. He got hurt, obviously, but I was one of his instructors with Paul Abel. You know, so most of our guys have been in that world, right?
And then you got some young guys now coming up.
And they're doing more of the sports
jiu-jitsu stuff, yeah, which is fine.
And they like the no-gi. Like, I like no-gi. Like, I really do enjoy no-gi. Like, mm-hmm. I enjoy the gi, I enjoy no-gi.
Sure.
I enjoy all of it. I hate being one-sided, man. I hate being one-dimensional. I like to learn everything, you know, and life is too short to sit there and just pick one thing and just not avoid, you know, things that I'm not comfortable with. It's the things I'm not comfortable with that usually help me the best.
100%.
You know?
Nice. And of course, like to kind of like round it out, this is like the bunker connection of Gracie Humaita is that you guys were able to come and compete for the first time last December.
Yeah.
That was awesome.
That was great.
Yeah. You guys had like four people, I think.
Yeah. I think four or five. I think we had a female too.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I can't remember exactly how many guys we had, but I think it was four or five.
I think you had four, I think.
Yeah. Maybe four guys and one girl.
I think so. Yeah. So that was really fun to have you guys come down and kind of like join us. And it's good to bring the dojos together. It's nice to meet new people. I was saying like in some of the other interviews that, you know, it's a place where it's like, it's controlled because we know the people. We know that they're safe.
I like the format.
Yeah.
I like the format. And I like the fact that the instructors that were there weren't the typical cocky, yelling, you know, break his arm type stuff. You know, it was very lighthearted. And
well, that's what we want. We don't want people getting hurt.
Yeah, it was cool. It was very lighthearted. It was a competition, but everybody knew why we were really here. We were really here for charity. You know, and I think that was the best part of it. Like, I go to these other competitions with my guys, and you know, ego is a thing, right? It's like and it can be, some jiu-jitsu competitions could be very ugly, and some could be very nice. Yours was one of the nicest ones I've ever been to.
Yeah, it's small. Like, it's small, and it's just, and we're going to keep it like that. Like, I think we want to keep it. We're going to keep it a blue belt. It's nice introductory level. It's good for people who have never competed before. Mm-hmm. They're nervous about it, so they can come to a place where, you know, it's a safe environment for them in the sense that we've never had any injuries. We don't want to have any injuries. Yeah, they're not going to be anybody there going to rip your arm off because they want to win. Like, what are they going to win, right?
Yeah, what's the purpose, right?
What's the purpose? We're there to learn. It's fun. Sure, you're going to have a winner. You have a loser, right? Like, but I think, when the goal, like you said, is, the goal is charity, for example, as opposed to I want to win a medal so I can say I was the best. Mm-hmm. It's a different mentality going into it, right?
Very welcoming. It was warm and welcoming. And it was, you know, the jokes, like, you're cracking jokes. The other instructors are cracking jokes.
We're
cracking.
It's fun.
It was like, it was so lighthearted.
It's lighthearted, yeah.
It was very good. Yeah. It was probably one of the best things that, you know, I was very happy with that.
Yeah, well, we're going to be doing it again this December, so it's going to be fun. And I think we're going to keep it at a 16-man tournament because it's manageable. I want to get more girls, right? Because last time we only had four. I want to maybe get eight, like try to get a little bit more for the females there. And some people said, oh, can we do some super fights maybe? Throw a little, maybe get a black belt to like just do some fun, like just to break it up a bit. Like give some chance for people to rest in between as we go to like the higher, like the final brackets and things like that. So maybe like So like some of my purple belt friends are like, oh, maybe like we can just have like a super fight in between.
Yeah.
You know, just for fun. Break up the monotony. That's right. Yeah. You know, maybe get a two brown belts just for the fun of it, you know what I mean? And then continue on with the rest of the competition. But you know, it's manageable. You're doing 2 to 3 hours. It's not too long. You do it in an evening, you know, maybe get some food next time.
Maybe the acai guy can come.
I want to get like a food truck or something. Like I want to do it like where it's even more laid back because it's in a banquet hall, mm-hmm. and we like that format, right? Because you can sit with your friends,
right?
And you can relax, right? And it's like I would say it's kind of like a lower level Who's Number One, like in the States. I wish we had those here in Canada. We don't have that. You know, where you go there and you can buy like tickets and you can sit and you have dinner right. and you can watch matches, right?
Right.
And this is like something like where I'd like to have that format because we don't have that here.
No, not at all. Anything. Nothing like that.
Where you just come chill yeah. with your friends. So I want to keep the tournament the same, keep it safe, keep it lighthearted, keep people that we trust. Like, there's like, I trust you. So you're going to, I know that you're going to bring me students that are not crazy.
Of course.
Spazzy, right? No way. I know Arthur's going to bring, you know, I know that Mark from NKS, like these groups that we know the students, right?
Right.
And they're not going to recommend people who are unsafe. We had some people who wanted to come and they were unsafe. And I said, no. Because I knew, like, it's just like, I love you, but this is not
right.
going to be not for you. I'm you're for you. A little dangerous, right? You want to go to, like, the Open or something, do something else. But this, no offense, but it is what it is.
That guy, Arthur, was a gentleman. I was really impressed by him.
You hadn't met him before?
I had never met him before. I'd seen him online.
He's been here for a long time, yeah.
But, yeah, very, very, very impressive guy, very friendly. Like, you can
talk to him. He's a sports guy. Yeah, right? He's a sports guy.
He's a normal guy. You know, you can sit down, have a beer with him just as well as you can do a private lesson with him or train with him. You know, you can go, he's like a normal dude. I really liked him. I thought he was a very nice man.
Yeah, he's, obviously he is on the sports side, right? Like, not on the self-defensive side, right? That's his thing, right? But he's like a phenom. Like he's
His jiu-jitsu is good, man.
Yeah, his jiu-jitsu is really good, and he's very technical.
Yeah.
So I work with him a lot. Like in my time, like he's taught me the most. Right. As a big guy, I never wanted to do the big guy jiu-jitsu because everybody does the big guy jiu-jitsu, right? Like what do big guys do? They smash. They smother, do pressure passing.
Yeah.
Then they snap down. They don't
get
them
to their back and they gas.
Yeah.
Out.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. So it's like. This is the classic jiu-jitsu that you see in competitions with big guys, with the ultra heavies. It's basically like lock antlers, you know, like the, you know, that's what it is, right? It's boring to watch. You know, they grab each other and they sit there and then eventually somebody falls over, right? Or maybe somebody has a judo throw or something, maybe. And then basically whoever's on top stays on top. Whoever's on the bottom stays on the bottom. And that's the end of it. And they just sit on each other.
It's not very dynamic.
It's not dynamic.
But it's good jiu-jitsu. Like
it's
still good jiu-jitsu.
It's effective, 100%. Good jiu-jitsu. But what I don't like about that, like why I didn't want to do that as far as for my game, is that I didn't want to just do what I want to get good at jiu-jitsu. I don't want to get good at just sitting on top of somebody. Like some guys just sit on them and do nothing. And okay, there's not a lot of technique there, right? Like so ironically, I work with Arthur, who's like a thin, tall, lanky guy, who's like, you know, that jiu-jitsu is really hard for a person like me. But that's what I've been doing because I play guard, which is insane for me.
Yeah, you're not the body type to play guard.
I'm not the body type. I know this because it's very hard.
Yeah.
Like, don't get me wrong. I'm not playing spider and things like that. I'm not inverting because I can't because I've got a belly. Like, you know, it's hard to invert. But I play a lot of half and deep half and things like that. Yeah. And you know, and I'm trying to do that because that's like you said, you do what's hard and what's scary. Like. That scares me, so that's
what I do. It's uncomfortable. I do the things that are uncomfortable.
Yeah. But that's, then it makes you well-rounded, because right. I don't want to be like, again, like, I'm old. Like, in the game, I'm old. I started at 38. I'm 44 now, right? Yeah. So I'm old for jiu-jitsu. So I don't want to be the old guy that if I ever make it to black belt, I want to be a good black belt. I don't want to just be the black belt that did his time and they gave it to me because he's old. Well, eventually, you got to promote the guy if he's consistent. Yeah. Like, what are you going to do, right? Like, the guy's 60 years old.
So they say, you know, they go,
you know,
Ele nunca vai ficar bom. He's never going to be good. That's a word.
There's lots of us like that.
They say that. Ele nunca vai ficar bom. Just give him the belt.
Yeah. Well, what are you going to do? Like, you got a guy training consistently and hard, and they're progressing.
Yeah.
They may not be the best, like, compared to other people, right? But, you know, they're working hard. What are you going to do? You're going to keep him at blue belt for the rest of their lives, right?
You got
to
promote.
Right? But I don't want to be the guy who just does one thing and it's like boring, like just over and over, right? So it is hard, but it's rewarding though to do things, like even if you mess up. So like for example, in competitions now, I pull guard, which is weird. Like, not pull guard like crazy Musumeci stuff, but I'll pull guard to half.
Right.
And then I'll work from there.
That's the most common.
Which is terrifying, though, when you have a 400-pound guy on top of you.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Because it's hard to move them. Like, it's like moving a boulder.
You're not going nowhere. Like, the guy.
No, but it's working now.
Right.
It's working. It worked in my last competition. I actually swept the guy. So it was like,
I saw your match.
Yeah, it was, but the guy was big. It was like, the guy was like 280.
Yeah, he
was
like, a big man.
He was like 6'7". Like, it was really hard, right? So,
yeah.
But, you know, it's, I think we should explore other things, like other things that are not common.
Absolutely.
So you know more about it, right?
Listen, when I train with my guys, like I'll roll. I pick who I train with, blues and purples and whatnot and browns, but I let them set up,
yes.
Like full setup. I go, okay, let's go. You know, you know,
do what you want to do. Get your grips.
He's a guard player. Yeah. Like, I got one playing lapel guard now. He wraps it up a lapel guard.
You got to get out of it.
I'm in danger. Like, yeah. I'm in danger from the get. You know, and he'll catch me. You know, he's really good. He's a good kid. He's one of my favorite training partners because he's not too heavy for my back, you know, and I can train. We can go hard. Yes. We can go light. We can flow. He's got a great head on his shoulders. His brother as well.
I know who you're talking about. Yeah, they're great kids. Yeah,
yeah, I love training with them. They're like, and I picked to train with them purposely because they're dangerous, just dangerous enough to keep me on my toes, you know.
Sure.
And then you add, like, they'll start mounted. So, you know, I let them start mounted. You know, I've got nothing to prove. But that is going to make me better, and it's going to make them better. So
yes.
It's this great exchange, you know. And as you get older, you find you're going to be doing that a lot more.
Yes.
You know? Otherwise, because if you sit there and you try to bang it out, this is insanity.
Yeah.
This is jiu-jitsu.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so you don't want to do the insanity. You want to do jiu-jitsu.
Yeah.
And so that's the best way to get. That's how I find I progress the most.
That's actually really, like, the way you said that is exactly like the way, like, I think of it. Like, at least, again, when you're an ultra heavy, it's hard to move people, right? Like, even when you're big, like, it's, people think it's like, oh, you're it's relative, right? You're both, let's say, 300 pounds or 200, whatever. It's the same thing as two smaller guys doing it. Not exactly.
No, not at all.
It's like moving. So you can't, if you just go strength for strength, A, you'll get hurt. Second of all, you're going to gas out. And I did that at the beginning because I didn't know. When I was a white belt, I started competing. And even at the beginning of blue, it's like, you know, it was like, why am I gassing out so much? I'm trying to move a mountain, right? So now it's more like, well, I can't go through it. I got to go around. I got to find another way.
You got to find another way.
So I see him as a rock.
Right.
And I'm not going to go through the rock because it's not going to.
It's crazy.
It's crazy, right? It's I'm going to exert all this energy trying to move this thing, this boulder. So it's either I'm going to go around one way or I'm going to go around the other. I got to find a different way. And that's where I gotta experiment with other things that are maybe not as common for bigger guys, but they'll be more effective. But you have to find another way, at least if you want to be efficient.
I saw some movie one time, and it, I kind of put it in my jiu-jitsu mind, and it was somebody, I think they were holding on to a cliff on the side of a building, and the person saying, "You have to let go to save yourself. You have to let go." And I find jiu-jitsu is like that.
Yeah,
the more you try to hold a person, the more they control you.
Yes.
And you, even though they're being defensive, you're on top. The more you try to hold them, the more they start imposing their will on you. Their hips starts affecting your balance, and they start getting underhooks and all kinds of weird stuff, right?
Yes.
But the more of a wet blanket you are, where you're not trying to control them, you're just kind of just you're playing, hanging in the wind, you're flapping in the wind. You bend with the wind. You pop up when the wind recedes, and you're more dangerous that way than you are the tighter you hold them. The tighter you hold them, the easier it is for them to load your weight on them.
They're connected to you. Yeah. They can move you, yeah.
And so I find that in jiu-jitsu, I play that in my head whenever I'm in a bad spot. You got to let go. Disengage.
Yeah.
Go the other way. Find another way. Even if it puts you kind of like tentatively in danger, like, you know, the running man escape, for instance. You do the running man escape. It kind of, you have a moment there where they can take
you. You're exposing your back. Yeah.
Right? But if you can surprise them, they're not going to take your back because you're too late. Now you're facing them. You're either getting up, attacking them, or you're pulling them into your guard.
Sure.
So these are important things that I learned through jiu-jitsu, you know. I thought you were going to ask me how I found God through jiu-jitsu because that's what I tell people that all the time.
Okay, you know what? Let's finish with that. I don't care if we're over an hour. Who cares?
Yeah.
How did you find God through jiu-jitsu?
Well, because jiu-jitsu is so difficult.
Yeah.
You know, and I think anytime you put yourself in really difficult, trying situations, especially when it's like when you're in pain and you're going through all these things, or like you say, a 300-pound rock is sitting in front of you. You know, there's no talking when you're doing this, right? So you're in your head. And a lot of times, you're not even thinking about the technique. You're just thinking about the pressure. You're not thinking about technique. You're feeling pressure, and you're feeling the difficulty. And then, you know, you don't know if it's your voice in your head, or you don't know what it is. You know, all of a sudden you feel like you're receiving something, you know, and it was like a connection. I whenever I find myself in difficult situations, I always feel like that's when I feel God's presence the most. Mm-hmm. I don't feel him in good times.
Yeah, it's
I feel him in the bad times. And a lot of times in jiu-jitsu, there's bad times. You know, it's a good time because you're rolling, but you know, you got a 300-pound monster sitting on top of you mounted, and they're smothering you with the mother's milk.
And you want to die.
Yeah. Yeah, and then there's something in your voice, that's in your head, that says, relax.
Yeah.
Breathe. You know, and it's not you. You know, I'm not that guy. In my head, I'm panic guy in my head. Mm. Freaking out.
Sure.
It's a calm voice, you know. And then I started thinking, man, you know, is this God talking to me? You know, mm-hmm. I know people say you're crazy because you think that way and whatnot, but I don't really care what people think in that regard. I'm a believer, and so jiu-jitsu is what made me more of a believer.
Yes.
And then you see the transformation that you have happen to you, and then when you're sharing it with people, the jiu-jitsu, you see that that positive energy transforming other people, mm-hmm. and all of a sudden their lives go from garbage to amazing. Mm-hmm. You know, I can't chalk it up to anything other than God. God's yeah. working through you. This person walked into the door for a reason. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they come in, they got problems, they're stressed out. You can see it in their face. You know, a 40-year-old guy, he looks like he's 60. Mm-hmm. And then he's training with you for 3-4 months. Now he went from looking 60 to 55. Now he looks 50. Now he's 45. Now he's 40. Now he looks 35.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
How do you explain that? It can't be only from training. Training is physical. It's great. But there's something on a spiritual level happening.
100%.
And I can't put my finger on it. But I'm not going to say, oh, you know, I'm not one of these holistic New Age guys. And I'm a Christian. Uh-huh. And so I can only chalk it up to God. I can only chalk it up to Jesus. You know, who else can I point the finger at for this transformation I see happening in people?
Well, you know, you see it a lot. Like I call it, it's the Jonah effect, because in the Old Testament, you know, Jonah, he gets eaten by the whale, right? Mm-hmm. And it's like, you know, you see this symbolism, like he's 3 days, just like Jesus in the tomb, right? It's like the parallel. And he's like in the depths of the sea, like deep. It's like you're in hell, right? And this is where he comes to himself, because Jonah is not a nice guy. It's a prophet, but he's like, he runs away. God's like, go to the Ninevites and tell them that, you know, they have to repent. He's like, I don't want to go to those guys. I hate those guys. I want you to burn them. I want you to smite them, right? And so he tries to run away, right? So he tries to go against the will of God and all this kind of stuff, the whole story. And then he, you know, he gets eaten by the whale, and now he's like down in the inside the whale, in the middle of the deep, like in the worst place ever. You're underneath a 300-pound guy, and you think you're dead, like, you know? And that's where he groans, like he prays to God, like from the depths of his soul, right? Like from the most difficult time. And that's how human beings are. Unfortunately, in the good times, we don't care about God. In the bad times, we fall on our knees,
right?
It's part of our nature, right? Because we're a little bit selfish, right? It'd be good if we also called to him in good times as well, right?
At least thank him.
That's the training for us in the church, right? It's like that we're trying to like be grateful all the time, so that we're not just selfish when in the bad times, right?
Like Job.
What?
Like Job.
Yeah, like Job. Exactly, right? It's like the Lord giveth and the Lord taketh,
right? That's right.
Blessed be the name of the Lord. That's the way it is. It's the good and the bad, right? But that's why I do it as a priest. Like I had a whole podcast through fighting priests before. I kind of stopped it now. But like that whole thing for 4 years that I did with Father Thomas, it was an exploration of why do it as an Orthodox Christian, right? Which was more of a niche thing. But we interviewed a lot of different Orthodox Christians, and especially priests who, like, we don't have any here in Canada, but in the States, we're the only two here in Canada that are actually Orthodox priests. But in the States, there's more mm-hmm. Orthodox priests who do jiu-jitsu.
Really?
Oh, yeah. So we had quite a few of them on the we found them. And we had them on the podcast. And we were all kind of talking about this and saying how it is like so... the parallels between jiu-jitsu and orthodoxy as from like, it's just from a spiritual point of view, like, yeah, jiu-jitsu has nothing to do with spirituality. Like it's a secular thing, right? The Brazilians made it secular, which is really good for us because you don't have any of that Eastern, you know, Tai Chi stuff, like Chi things.
Oh my goodness.
That's in with traditional Japanese jujitsu and all this other kind of stuff, right? So it's good for us as Orthodox Christians because we can engage with it and use it, right? It's not, it doesn't have all that spiritual baggage, right? Of other religions. But I find that it's ironically, it's the dojo a lot of times is more of a church than the actual church. Absolutely. And what do I mean by that? I'm not denigrating the church, obviously, right? But it's like, you know, in the church, we say, okay, we're not supposed to judge. We're not supposed to, like, you know, gossip. Like, we all do these things because we're human beings, right? But I find that the dojo, it's like the most accepting place ever. No one cares who you are. No one cares what your background is. No one cares what your politics are. When you're on the mats, you're just, it's all meritocracy. It's like, can you do this or can you not do this? That's all we care about.
That's it.
I don't care who you are. They don't care if I'm a priest. They don't care if the other guy's a cop. They don't care if the other guy's a judge. They don't care anything. You could be royalty. No one cares. They'll choke you out just the same.
That's right.
Which I like about that because it's humbling. It keeps you low and it keeps you like, it reminds you like you're nothing. You're nothing. Like no one cares, right? And that's really, for me as a priest, it's really, really good because when you're a leader, you can get too high in yourself. 100%, 100%. And that's not good for priests, not good for bishops, not good for anybody in leadership positions, right? The jiu-jitsu keeps me like humble. And then like you said, like it also teaches you to be calm under those really, really difficult times, which we say in a spiritual, you have to trust God, right? And not like trust God like he's going to fix all your stuff like the Protestants say, you know, like, oh, it's all going to be good. No, maybe it's not going to be good. Maybe you're going to die.
That's right.
Maybe you're going to lose everything. Maybe you'll be in the street. But even then, like, you got to stay calm. That's what I'm saying. Like, when I compete, it's like, it's an exercise in staying calm when you mess up because I always mess up. It's like, in my fights, it's always like the second half is better. The first half, I always screw up.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, oh, I'm in a bad situation now. I'm going to lose. It's my mind. It's like, the last one you were watching, I'm in Turtle. This is not good.
Yeah, but you pull that sweep out.
Yeah, I know, but turnover, I mean, you got but rip. I'm saying what I was thinking. I'm telling you what my interior monologue was at that time. I was calm because I've done it a few times. It's good for me because I've gotten where I'm not panicking, right? But it took a long time to get to that point, like anybody, right? Like when they compete the first time, they freak out, right? And some people always freak out. Some people never get over the jitters, you know what I mean? Like
that's why I don't compete.
Yeah, Arthur tells me this. Arthur, who's competed hundreds of times. Hundreds of times, he still gets nervous.
Yeah, that's why I don't. I used to compete in taekwondo a lot.
Yeah,
and then in jiu-jitsu, I did an in-house burner one time.
Yeah.
It wasn't even a real competition. Yeah. It was just they made us do it, kind of like last second, come on in, everybody go on that wall, you guys go on that wall.
Yeah.
And now we're doing competition matches. I panicked. You know that it's not for me. Now in that format, it was okay because I didn't have nothing to think about the night before.
Sure.
So I wasn't throwing up. I wasn't on the toilet freaking out. But that's why, you know, and I always had that experience in taekwondo. You know, whenever I competed in Berkeley one time with our team. And, you know, all the week leading up to that thing, I was a mess. I was a wreck,
sure. You
know. And I did well. It wasn't like I didn't do well. I would do well.
And it's all that suffering. I never got
gold. You know, I would get like bronze or silver. But it was all that suffering. I didn't enjoy it. It's like a roller coaster.
Yeah.
I've been on tons of roller coasters. Guess what? I hate roller coasters.
So don't do it.
So I don't ride them.
Yeah.
You know, and that's great. You know, if you like roller coasters, that's great for you. It's not good for me.
Yeah, 100%. You
know? But I still have enough to contribute to where my team, like even John Danaher, he never competed. Look at him. Look at his guys.
Body never allowed him to. Yeah, of course. Yeah.
They're monster. His guys are all monsters. You know, I don't think that's.
Well, his mind.
That should be the measure. You know, the measure is, the measure should be on what your students turn out.
Yeah,
you know that should be the measure, and what kind of person are you?
Yeah,
you know how you turn out, and you know, just like self defense, I don't think people should discount God. You know that's everybody's willing to throw out the self defense, but it's you need that.
Yes,
and everyone's willing to forget God, but you don't realize how much you really need that. Like, it's even more than self defense. You need that. You need that more than anything else. You know, and. You're supposed to love God more than anything else.
Yes.
More than anything else. More than your children. More than your wife. More than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we don't live in a time where people feel like this anymore. Mm-hmm. And the people that do, you know them. You know.
Sure.
You know them. You know, it's like, and just the way they live and the way they carry themselves. You know, that's how they are. They truly believe this. You know, and jiu-jitsu was my path back to God because I discounted God. I was born Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, got my communion, got my confirmation. Then my family was like born again Christian. I became that, And then now I was Catholic. I stayed Catholic. I was a Royal Ranger. You ever heard of the Royal Rangers?
No.
It's a Christian Boy Scout type thing. I was a Boy Scout. And then I, you know, fast forward to when I became Greek Orthodox, you know, it had been something I was talking about with my son since he was about 7 years old, that I wanted to become Orthodox because I felt that I was drawn to it. It was something about it. And it was jujitsu that did it. It wasn't through my Greek family, you know, adopted family, because they adopted me into their family. They had no influence in that. It was jujitsu. Jujitsu has been the vehicle for everything good in my life. Mm-hmm. Always had. And on the same flip side, a lot of the bad things in my life, physical problems, right?
Yeah, but the physical, we're all going to get sick. We're all going to get old. We're all going to get decrepit. So you might as well do it with doing jujitsu. That's why I said it's like, you know what I'm saying?
You're going to die anyway.
Yeah, you know, I'm going to have a walker at some point in my life. But the difference is, am I going to get there sitting on a couch eating chips? Or am I going to get it like busting my knees up doing like jujitsu? I'd rather do something, you know, that's valuable and have the aches and pains from that than doing
Grandmaster Elio.
He died.
The week before he died, he was still come downstairs. He had that farm, right? That property, that Azopolis, I believe it was.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you hear the stories from Hoyler, Hoyce, Pedro Valenci, and all those dudes, they tell you, man, even up to the last day, he was like, I guess he got sick.
But weeks before, he was still wearing a gi.
And he was still putting his gi on, and come here, I've been working on a choke.
Yeah. It's awesome.
He's been working on a choke. He's 90-something years old.
That's wicked.
His career's over, and he's still working on a choke.
Yeah.
Man, what an inspiration. Like, if you get nothing else from jiu-jitsu, at least get that.
Yeah. And at the end of his life, he was putting on a blue belt again, the old school. Like, he was just like,
yeah,
it's enough. Like, he was just, that's what people see.
That's because they were giving out black belts. That was his protest against people getting black belts, you know, too easily.
Yeah.
You know, and I get it, you know.
Yeah, it should be hard.
Yeah.
And still, like, compared to other martial arts, jiu-jitsu still is the hardest martial art to get a black belt. Like, it's the longest, even when they're giving it out too quickly. It's still longer than every other martial art.
You know? And it's terrible if you suck. You know, for me, it took 14 years.
Yeah. Yeah, sure.
14 years to get my black belt. If that's any
I don't want to think about how long it's going to
commentary on how my jiu-jitsu is, you know,
But you had breaks, too. You had
absolutely, kids, yeah. But I'm not living under any delusion. Like, I know my abilities and I know what I can and can't do.
Sure.
And jiu-jitsu will that's the thing about jiu-jitsu, is you know as well, that it really highlights, you know, the things you can't do. Like,
you can't hide.
It shows your weaknesses.
And you can't fake it.
That's right. You cannot fake it. And so you can fake almost everything else in life. Front. And it's a great lens.
Yeah. Yeah. Right? And on that, I think that's a great point to stop, because we're already at 1:15. Sorry. Way over. No, it's a great conversation, right? But we're going to kind of wrap it up, just because, you know, I think it's a good place, and that's a good place to finish. And thanks, David.
Thank you for
having
me.
I really appreciate it.
Appreciate it.
I appreciate you having the time to come. And it's nice that we did it in person, too, because a lot of times we don't have a chance to do this in person, so it's kind of nice to kind of just sit on the couch and talk.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, then, thank you again. Looking forward to having you guys again at the Bunker in December.
Looking forward to it.
Hopefully I'll be able to come up and train with you guys and visit in the summer.
Like I said, I'd like to have a session with you and your kids to work on some self-defense, you know, just for fun.
Sure.
And then throw some food in your belly and for your wife as well, right? And
we'll do it. I'm not going to say no.
That'd be great.
I appreciate it. Okay, and thanks everybody for listening, and we'll see everybody in a week. Take care, everyone.
Thanks for listening to the Bunker Jiu-Jitsu podcast. Feel free to follow us on Instagram and YouTube. And if you want to reach out with any questions, or if you're interested in being on the show, feel free to email us at bunkerjujitsu@gmail.com. Thanks and take care.